Okay, I'm speaking with Douglas Rushkoff, whose new book is Present Shock. Doug, the title of your book, Present Shock, is a reference to Alvin Toffler's 1970 book, Future Shock. What's the difference between future shock and present shock?
Well, I guess in some sense, maybe the sensation might be similar. The real difference is that the future that Alvin Toffler was describing that we were moving towards is here with us now. So while Toffler was really warning us to really to learn how to orient to a world that was changing ever more rapidly, you know, to basically be able to adjust to change itself, I'm arguing that that change has happened, that if anything, you know, as we passed from the 90s into the 21st century, we became less of a society that was just obsessed with the future and what's next and what's happening, what's the next big thing, where is it all going? And we became a society that was very much in the moment, in a kind of an always-on, real-time, hyper-connected moment. So our focus really becomes less about how do we adjust to change, to something much more like how do we adjust to living in a world where everything is happening seemingly at the same time.
Well, I'm wondering if that just means that the speed of change is so fast now that you almost, at least from your perspective, you almost can't plan for the future because what's happening next week or next month is just we just can't keep track of it.
Right, that it reaches me in some sense, perhaps such a rate that it no longer feels like incremental change. It no longer feels like we're going from this to that to this, but that we're in this constant, steady state, kind of chaotic, in some sense, mess. But really, I think that the real difference between future shock and present shock is kind of less about change itself than more about what it's like to live in this kind of real-time, always-on existence, you know, without a past or a future, without origins or goals, really just being in the present all the time. And then what does that do to us, you know, socially, politically, personally, economically? You know, how do you plan for the future? How do you think about, you know, where you are if there's no longer a track, no longer a story through which to organize our experience?
Well, you break this idea of presentism down into five big areas, and let's talk about those. One you call narrative collapse. Can you describe what you mean by that?
Yeah, it's funny. I guess presentism is the more positive way of experiencing all this. Real presentism would be kind of being in the moment, where present shock is kind of the inability or the initial human response to presentism, which isn't always which isn't always smooth. So yeah, the first one that I was looking at was called narrative collapse, and that's really just, you know, what is it to live in a world without stories, where there's no longer time to tell a story from beginning, middle to end. You know, we use narratives really since Aristotle's time and maybe before, you know, as a way of conveying human values. You create a character that the audience likes and you put that character through a series of trials until they reach a crisis of some kind and have some, you know, great climax and realization, and then everyone can relax, you know, and that's the basic structure of, you know, all our TV shows, all our movies, all our novels.
Well, and I have to say, I mean, it's the most popular TV shows out there, at least the most acclaimed ones, seem to still heavily deal with this kind of narrative structure. I mean, you know, Game of Thrones, Mad Men. I mean, there's definitely a narrative structure
yes
there.
Yes, no. There's narrativity in something like Game of Thrones. But Game of Thrones is actually a great example in that it doesn't really have a beginning, a middle, and an end the way we normally think of it. It's not like some two-hour movie that has that, you know, that act structure mechanism that you can almost feel, you know, clicking into place as you move from the end of Act One to the hero's journey at the beginning of Act Two. You know, it's become so predictable at this point. But Game of Thrones really moves in a much more presentist fashion. It's in some ways, it's a throwback to the old soap operas that grandma used to watch, you know, her stories, where you watch these things and they just go on and on and on. Game of Thrones is structured a bit more like a fantasy role-playing game, like Dungeons and Dragons, where really the object of the game is not to win the game and reach the end in a typical narrative fashion, but to figure out how to keep the game going as long as possible. And these kind of open-ended structures, to me anyway, feel much more consonant with the challenges of living in a sustainable society. You know, on the bigger scale, we no longer really have these grand narratives shaping, you know, our politics or, you know, colonialism or the American story. It's much more about how are we all going to get along over the long term. And that might not look like victory in the traditional sense.
Well, and I'm also thinking about how we consume media. I mean, if we're watching TV, chances are we're sitting there with the remote button at our fingertips. You know, if things start to drag a little bit, you know, we're going to click to the next channel. Or if we're browsing on the web, you know, we're constantly jumping from one website to another. I suppose that's kind of what you're talking about.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the remote control is definitely the first, you know, weapon in our arsenal against, you know, narrative coercion, if you will. And I think most of us growing up in the 70s and 80s, you know, we experienced the television as programming. You know, we understood that these advertisers didn't have our best interests at heart, and people were putting us into a state of anxiety just to sell us something. And the remote control really let us zip away from that, you know, and whether they claimed that we had short attention spans or ADD or whatever it was, we were certainly back in the days of Generation X, we were skipping away before they had a chance to really get their claws into us. You know, and now with, you know, DVRs or even more so with something like Netflix, people have, you know, the ability to do, you know, extreme a la carte and, you know, asynchronous or atemporal viewing. Now, remember with this House of Cards show, it's like even if you were watching it and people at work were watching it, you still couldn't talk about it because they might be on episode 7
right,
while you're on episode 3. So everybody's watching extremely in their own time.
Yeah. Now, you write about another condition that you call digiphrenia. What is this?
Well, digiphrenia is interesting, and it kind of comes out of that video game sensibility. I mean, the beauty of video games in a world with narrative collapse is that instead of watching some other character go through a story, you're the one going through the story. You know, you're the one making the choices in real time, and you move from choice to choice to choice to choice rather than watching these canned choices. It's the sense of agency. But, you know, the digital environment very often makes it seem like you don't even have to choose. You don't have to choose between this and that. You can choose both. You know, and we're doing so many things online where we're choosing both that we've ended up with really multiple instances, multiple incarnations of ourself kind of running simultaneously on all these different platforms. And it's very hard to live with more than one you. You know, digital technology is great for copying things, but human beings don't copy so well. So there's you on Twitter that maybe somebody's commenting on something that you did. There's you in your inbox that's filling up with messages that are waiting for responses. There's you on Facebook who might be being used to advertise a product you never even heard of while you're asleep, you know, and you'll wake up that you've been in these sponsored stories. You know, so how do you deal with all of these different sort of yous running simultaneously? That's sort of the essence of this digital, you know, digiphrenia or this kind of digital confusion.
So you're basically saying that it's enough to make you a little crazy. I mean, you know, there's almost like a split personality here because we're tending to so many different digital personae.
Right, and even if your personality is not split, your digital personalities are split, and your single personality is going to have to deal with all of them. You know, there was this. I got the idea for the digiphrenia chapter when I was in the lobby of a hotel in Berlin. I kept trying to log into my Google Calendar to see if I could do one talk at the same time as another talk, whether I'd be able to get from one to the other in time. And each place I went, I couldn't log in until I finally got Wi-Fi, and I'm in this lobby. And I get this message back from Google that they locked me out of my calendar because they said I was trying to log in from too many places at once, right? So Google Calendar didn't believe I was a human being. They didn't believe one human could be in all those places at once. And that, to me, seemed to be the essence of, you know, the problem we have with digital culture. It's not this idea of information overload and, you know, all these people have all these problems with digital technology. And this, I promise you, Present Shock is not one of these books. It's just, you know, whining and hand-wringing about the problems of digitality. You know, but what I do get concerned about is our readiness to really to put our human lives into digital time frames. You know, digital technologies really don't understand time. They live outside time. They're just sequences. You know, your Twitter feed is not in real time. It's just trying to catch up with you. You know, just because people are sending emails out to you in you know, it doesn't mean that now you have to respond in real time to them, right? The beauty of digital technology was that it waited. You know, the early conversations we used to have on the bulletin boards, we were all so smart because we had all the time in the world to respond to these things. We sounded smarter online than we did in real life.
Right. Well, now, and the irony, yeah, of course, is that this was supposed to make our life better. It was supposed to make it easier, and it seems like it's just made us feel crazier.
Right. And that's because, and I mean, and not to get, you know, leftist on you or anything, but I really do believe it's because instead of using digital technology kind of for slack, which is what we saw it as, right? We're all going to be able to work from home in our underwear anytime we want, you know, because we'll just get our work done and turn it in as it's ready, rather than going to work for this 8 hours a day and being always on while you're there. What we ended up doing instead was kind of taking the time is money efficiency values of the industrial age and translating them onto the digital age, where digital technology really, if we're going to embrace it the way I think we can, it's about really liberating ourselves from these obsolete industrial age priorities and embracing a totally different really way of working in a much more peer-to-peer fashion where we create value and sell it directly to one another rather than going in and having these sort of 9-to-5 jobs that are really just a relic of the first factories of the 1300s.
Well, one example that you write about, sort of this sense of split personality, is drone planes. You know, people who are sitting in their hometown somewhere in the United States and actually piloting drones to go on bombing missions on the other side of the world. You know, talk about kind of being in two different places at the same time.
I know. It's a pretty interesting one. You know, I went to the drone pilots because I was, you know, I guess thinking along more typical lines that, oh, well, you know, I'm going to go and see these drone pilots. I'm going to be able to write about how insensitive they are to, you know, the real crime and bloodshed that they're causing thousands of miles away. And what I found out was drone pilots actually experience higher rates of post-traumatic stress disorder than real pilots do. And I was really trying to figure out, now, what's that about? You know, the Army said, well, it was actually because of most of these pilots had actually been in real planes before. So these planes were probably the virtual experience was bringing up the terror that they experienced there. But I didn't really think that was enough to explain it. And then I saw the way these pilots actually live is, you know, all day long they'll be sitting in their little control thing, you know, doing their virtual bombings and killing people and whatever they need to do. Then they hop in their car, they drive home to suburban Las Vegas, and they have dinner with their wives and their kids and their babies. It's like, how do you live those two lives at once? You know, the real pilots get to go back to the, you know, the officer's lounge and, you know, whatever they do, but they're with the other people. They're physically in the world of the thing that they're doing.
And there's a sense they're still in the combat zone there, whereas the drone pilots are not, even though what they are doing is they are engaging in warfare.
Right. And they're living, it really is a kind of a double life. You know, there's no buffer between the shooting and hugging one's child. You know, it's bizarre. But on some level, I mean, even though they have more post-traumatic stress disorder, And there is that sort of schizophrenia that goes along with it, that confusion. On the other hand, it kind of makes me hopeful that these technologies will not just isolate us or distance us from the repercussions of what we're doing. If anything, it kind of drives home how real it is, because you don't have that buffer of, you know, an 18-hour plane flight to come back and you're welcome home. You're just in both worlds at the same time.
Now, another aspect of this presentism that we've been talking about is what you call overwinding. What do you mean by overwinding?
Yeah, it's funny. I got the idea for overwinding when I was rereading Stuart Brand's great book, The Clock of the Long Now, in order to write this one. And, you know, what he argues in there is that we need to think in these great sort of 10,000-year time spans.
And this is sort of following up on an actual clock that is being built, or maybe has been built, that will last 10,000 years.
Right. I mean, I'll be interested to see if they actually finish the actual clock. I guess there's enough money that went into it. You know, to me, it was just as valuable as a thought experiment, really, you know, that we're going to, you know, what would it be like to build this thing? What would it mean? The most important thing is that now he wants us to think in these 10,000-year spans rather than, you know, just, you know, next year or even next century. You know, what is the impact of this over 10,000 years? And I was trying to do that, you know, and I had this plastic water bottle. I was about to get on a plane. I didn't see a recycle bin. There was just a trash can there. And I'm like, do I just throw it out? You know, is it going to be 10,000 years? And I realized it wasn't feeling like a long now to me. It was feeling more like a short forever. You know, and that's where I got the idea of overwinding, where in a presentist society and an always-on sort of micro-moment managed society, it's very tempting to try to compress these really long timescales into really short periods of time. So you'll see examples of that, say, you know, on the stock market, where people don't buy in order to invest in the future of a company, they buy in order to make money on the trade, right? So people buy Facebook in the morning and they're mad 5 minutes later that it hasn't gone up and they go sell it, you know, and people who aren't satisfied with that, you know, they end up buying derivatives on stocks, which are really just a way to buy the future stock now, or buy a derivative on the derivative.
Right. And that's such a weird way to think about how we now run our financial system, and which presumably is based on the welfare of companies, of business.
Well,
it's not.
Of course not. It's not at all. It's based on derivatives of derivatives, these abstractions of the actual marketplace, which is itself an extraction off, you know, supply and demand of what people actually need. But it's gotten so real, so big, you know, that now by the last estimate I saw, derivatives exchanges account for 300 times more transactions in terms of value than real exchanges. They've gotten so big, you know, the New York Stock Exchange last month was actually purchased by a derivatives exchange. You know what that means is that the real stock market was bought by its abstraction, was bought by the thing that was based on it. You know, and that's overwinding when we're trying to jam in so much time and future time and meta time and time over time into real time that it just kind of bursts.
So are there solutions here? I mean, one of the things that you talk about is what you call spring loading. What's that?
Well, spring loading would be a sort of a positive way of looking at winding, sort of saying, okay, we can do time compression, but let's do it, you know, consciously and willfully rather than just as a way of trying to beat the clock. Or let's at least apply it to areas where timing is necessary. So there's a hospital, you know, it's a hospital in Israel, and I forgot the actual name of it now. What they did was they wanted to be able to sort of have a hospital in a box that you could just pop on a soccer field somewhere and it would just kind of expand. So what they do is they take a whole lot of time and they put into preparation, you know, okay, what if we're going to have an OBGYN clinic and we're going to have a disease thing and a virus control and something for refugees and starvation. You know, they work out the whole thing and they actually do pop it into these crates and stick it on a cargo plane and they sit and wait. You know, and when the Haiti earthquake happened and when the Japanese tsunami happened, you know, Israel sent over this plane. They popped this thing out on parachutes and, you know, the doctors and nurses land on a different plane. And in hours, they have a giant working hospital. You know, the hospital they put in Haiti was better than any local Haiti hospital, you know, and they just dealt with, you know, such high volumes of people. And that's really just this sort of a kind of a positive way of looking at time, how you can compress something and then explode it out. Or, you know, or in another case, it's a more just a matter of acknowledging the more natural cycles in a person's life or in a business rather than just trying to wind us up all the time. You know, when we don't feel like producing work, you know, if you're a blogger and you're supposed to be getting out 10,000 words a week and you're having a week that doesn't feel that productive, I mean, what they do, they'll take Adderall or Ritalin, one of the speeds, in order to squeeze the words out. Whereas if you look at sort of the natural underlying biological rhythms of real people, it turns out we all have these productive weeks, these contemplative weeks, these social weeks, you know, and if you really try to work against them rather than with them, you end up screwing yourself up. And the same with businesses that want this, they call it, you know, the hockey stick shaped graph, you know, up where they just have, you know, always doing more and accelerating upwards, you know, and bigger is better. That just doesn't make sense for businesses that have more kind of cyclical, you know, demand cycles. And if you can't allow yourself the natural cycles of time, you know, you are going to burn yourself out, whether it's as an individual or as a whole culture.
Well, I have to wonder about how you handle all of this stuff. I mean, I have this image of you as this incredibly wired guy, plugged into every new gadget out there. Is that true?
I'm not, believe it or not. You know, I'm really selective because, I mean, what I keep arguing for people to learn how to do is to really restore some agency, you know, to use the stuff that they want to use, but use stuff that they are in charge of and dispense with the stuff that they're not. So, you know, I dropped off, you know, Facebook a month or so ago, right before I came out with the book, which was probably a strategic error.
Right, you're supposed to be on Facebook to plug your book.
Yeah, but it just seems so you know, inappropriate given the things I'm arguing, which is, you know, take charge of your online personas and what's happening, you know, to know that, you know, that here we are in a world where, you know, Mark Zuckerberg can use our image and name any way he wants to. I couldn't sit there with an author page soliciting likes from people who are going to be used, you know, God knows how. But yeah, I'm just not always on. I've learned how to take the phone off and not have it vibrate every time anyone wants something from me. You know, that's an existence that's much more appropriate for a, you know, an emergency room doctor, you know, while he's on call, or a 911 operator, or a air traffic controller. You know, these are not this kind of always on, buzz me, I've got to be available to anyone who says anything at any time. That mindset, it's like, I remember when I was a kid, you know, it would be like the operator would break into the call
right
when, you know, grandma's dying or something. And it happened maybe twice throughout my entire childhood. And now it happens to people, you know, 20 or 30 times a day. And it's not worth interrupting for. So the whole trick, I think, is that, you know, digital technology, all technology, gives us more choice. And we've always associated choice with agency, right? Choice with, now I have more choice. But choices can also be interruptive. You know, if I'm sitting talking to you right now on the radio and my phone vibrates with, you know, oh, there's a call or a thing. Yes, it's giving me choice, but it's extracting me from the moment I'm actually in. So I'm not having a choice over whether I'm going to be more choice is going to be introduced.
Well, I mean, that's really the key question is, are you present in the thing, in the choice that you've made, you know, whatever technology you're using or whether it's no technology at all? I mean, are you fully there doing that thing?
Right. And we like to think that we can be fully present while we also have a marginal awareness of all of the potential distractions. And I'm kind of here to say no. Would that it were so, but even if it was, there's something to be gained from fully immersing in what you're in. Not for your whole life. You don't have to go Unabomber style and disappear from everything, but to take even, let's just start, you know, I know it's hard for people, but 5 or 10 minutes a day where you're going to actually just do the thing you're doing. If you're having a phone call or a meal with someone, you know, and if there's like one person who needs to be able to get in touch with you no matter what, you can give them a special ring on the phone so they can get through to you even in those 5 or 10 minutes if they're going to have a life-changing emergency, you know, come up. And when you start living like that, you realize, oh my God, I've been so hungry for this. You know, because only with that kind of engagement do all the steroids and hormones and neurotransmitters and mirror neurons and all that stuff, does all that get activated. You know, when you have a group of people in a room and they're all on their devices, I promise you their brain chemistry and blood chemistry is different than if they're in a room together. You know, that that feeling is different. You miss out on the social reality. And when you do, you are a better target for manipulation. You're a better target for advertising. You're a weaker person when you're talking to your boss. You're a less creative individual. You're less grounded. You're less politically viable. You know, all of these ways that human beings gather together and create strength are based on presence. You know, you go back to the Martin Luther King days where they would sing. You know, why would they sing when the cops came in? It's because it created a social reality that really gave them power.
Well, it raises questions, fascinating questions about what we mean by real time. I mean, there was a traditional sense of real time of, you know, it was kind of what we would do with our physical body, you know, not dealing with any kind of digital technologies. And yet real time, has taken on an entirely different meaning now.
Oh, it has. I mean, yeah, exactly. Real time means this sort of always on Twitter feed. Oh, that's real time. And of course, that's not real time. That's 5 minutes ago, 10 minutes ago, 10 seconds ago. It's still not you in real time. You know, the Greeks actually understood this, you know, way back when, even with the sundial or whatever they had. They had two different words for time. You know, there's the typical one, chronos, which means time of the clock, like it's, you know, 4:01. And they had this other word, kairos, which meant timing. And timing was more about your readiness or the appropriateness. Timing was what only humans could really understand. It's like, you know, I crashed the car at 4:01, but what's the best time to tell Dad that I crashed the car? You know, is that 5:01? No, it's timing. You know, that's after he's had his drink and before he's opened the bills, right? It's much more subtle. And that as you more and more time you spend aware of timing and being ready, the more you begin to connect with all of these cycles that, you know, you could call them new age, but they're actually real. I mean, when you ask me how I work according to the moon. You know, I became aware of Irving Dardik, this Olympic trainer who was getting all these great results by sort of matching people's workout routines to lunar cycles and looking at, you know, different weeks have different tides, and it also affects your body's chemistry differently.
Wait, so how do you do this? You work according to the lunar cycle?
Yeah, believe it or not. You know, because what you know, new research is showing. I mean, you can see it in the book or go to, there's a bunch of places like, you know, somaspace.org is a great place to look at this stuff, or go to Irving Dardik's Superwave site. You know, and so this is edge science, if you will. So it's the kind of thing that, you know, you do a little experimentation on yourself and just see what works and what doesn't. But what I found out from them was that over a 28-day lunar cycle, there's sort of four main weeks. You know, and, you know, 28 days is 4 7-day weeks. And in each week, a different neurotransmitter seems to dominate our brain chemistry. The first week is acetylcholine. The second week is serotonin. Third week is dopamine. And the last week is norepinephrine. So if you know that, you go, oh my gosh, it's not just me, but everybody's on acetylcholine this week. That means they're going to have good energy, right? They're going to be peppy. It's going to be great for introducing them to new ideas. Serotonin week, everybody's going to have a lot of energy to work. You know, everybody's going to be very productive. So that's when I do my writing. I don't even worry about it the next week. Dopamine week, you're not going to get anything done dopamine week. That's when you're going to go skiing and party and go nuts, right? And the final week, norepinephrine, that's the fight or flight neurotransmitter. So that's putting everybody in a very sort of analytic, structural, sort of, you know, Barack Obama mindset, you know, where you're looking at, that's where to organize my calendar. That's when to organize the chapters of my book. So when I did that, I stopped thinking of dopamine week, which did turn out to come up every month as writer's block. That's not what it is. It's something else. This is the time when I'm going to enjoy people and have my parties and do my crazy stuff. You know, and then when I looked at it that way, you know, and I just did it by my efficiency in terms of words, my word count went up about 40%.
Really?
When Yeah, when I worked really according to these sort of underlying biological clocks. And this stuff, which we look at as, you know, folklore now, you got to remember, you know, we looked at jet lag as folklore and old wives' tales until it was, you know, major league managers, a baseball manager, started to realize their pitchers did way better when they traveled from the East Coast to the West than when they traveled from the West Coast to the East. And it didn't make sense until they really came to understand how biological clocks work, our relationship, you know, to our melatonin in the sun. And there's all of these other cycles, things that, you know, that's what keeps people alive and in time. You know, and when we ride roughshod over it, either with, you know, shift work, trying to be always on, trying to have the same responses in the second week of a cycle as the third or the fourth, that we're always the same. I mean, you can push over it if you're a professional. You can do your show every day. But if you become aware of it, you can realize, oh, my shows this week are going to be more like this and my shows that week are going to be more like that. You can really schedule, you know, your sort of intellectually challenging ones.
You're giving me whole new ideas on how to produce radio here.
It's true. And then put the music stars and those folks on dopamine week, you know, and you can play a tune and do all that. It really does work.
You know, we've been talking about this whole obsession that we have now with living in the present moment and how everything just seems to be happening right now. And it seems to me that there are some real risks to this, and that's our ability to deal with long-term problems. And, I mean, what you say is, you know, we've often lost sight of cause and effect. And to me, the obvious example of this would be climate change. I mean, there's, you know, we know that the stuff that's happening now is going to have profound and dire consequences years from now, decades from now. And do we even have the capacity to think about that kind of problem anymore?
Well, I think we have the capacity to think about it. I do think it's hard for a highly presentist society to do things for, you know, the fifth generation down the line. I think it's going to be a lot easier to motivate people in what you would have to call a presentist way. In other words, it's politics and activism that looks a lot more like the Occupy movement maybe than it does like, you know, the traditional environmental movement. That the reason, we'll have to see if it works, you know, but, you know, the reason you do something is because it really feels more appropriate in the present. You know, it's inappropriate to create waste and pollution and this exhaust all the time. It's if you're really aware of the present, do you really want to be getting on a jet plane to go to some whole other place just to have some meeting? You know, what are you doing? You know, you don't need to look necessarily at, you know, what's happening to this fuel 1,000 years from now and where did it come from 100,000 years before? That somehow it seems less relevant to people that way. You know, there's a website I was looking at the other day called slaveryfootprint.org. And what it does is it, you know, lets you calculate, given, you know, your car and your house and how many clothes you have and things, it lets you calculate how many slaves are working for you right now. You know, because there's all such a slave labor in the world. You know, little kids in wherever, Singapore, sewing your underwear. And little boys in Pakistan making bricks or whatever. When you calculate that, it's not looking at the sort of the future impact of what you're doing, but the current impact of what you're doing right now. You're going to buy a diamond engagement ring. Who's dying for that right now in Africa? You're going to buy another cell phone. You know, who's out there getting the molybdenum for that? And what is the process that they're using to do it? Whose soil and topsoil is being polluted right now? You know, it really does, in some ways, it makes it more real rather than, oh, I'm going to do something good for someone else in some future moment. But it's definitely hard. You know, in the old days, we just made a campaign that we win. We're going to go fight the Russians. We're going to go get a flag on the moon before the end of the decade and just stick it in the surface of, you know, Tranquility Bay. And we did it. You know, how do you get the feeling of we did it, you know, in an environmental crisis, in a more chronic condition like hunger, you know, and pollution? You can't. So you need to develop more kind of real-time sustainable approaches rather than these winner-takes-all victories.
Now, we've been talking about your book, Present Shock, which you have described as the most important book you've written, and you've written a bunch of them. You've also said it may be your last book. Why do you say that?
Well, it occurred to me when I was writing this book with just how hard it was to carve out the time, you know, between having a wife and daughter and having people emailing and you don't make that much money writing a book anymore, but all the opportunities that come up to actually earn a little money here or there, write this article, do this talk. All the things I had to say no to in order to create the time to actually write this thing. I was going to have this marginalia where over the course of the book, you could see all the things I had to say no to in order to keep writing the book. But the marginalia became so much bigger than the book itself. It was just too silly. So I ended up sort of mentioning it there. But, so it took me, 2 years of writing to do this thing. An act that takes 2 years is so strange. It's such an anachronism in a world where, people are expressing themselves in 140 character, tweets that take 10 or 20 seconds to compose. Then I'm asking people to spend, 5, 6, 7 hours to actually read this book with their lives the way they are, when getting them to read an 800-word piece on, my CNN column is work enough. What am I doing? I said, right in there, I feel like I'm singing opera, when people are buying singles on iTunes. It's a beautiful thing and it should still exist, but oh my God. I can get, if I get on like Colbert Report, right, for 6 minutes, I reach more people in that 6 minutes than have read and will read everything I've ever written combined.
Yeah, but on the other hand, how much can you actually say in those 6 minutes?
I know.
Of course, the whole point of a book is you can have a sustained argument, with lots of different, points to it. And, don't we need that longer form, more carefully reasoned argument? Maybe that's just not your thing anymore, though.
No, it is. It's my thing, and I can't get away from it. Keep dragging me back. What I did realize, and I've always done it this way. I write books that are meant to be books. There's a lot of people that seem to use the form factor of a book to do these other things. Like, here's a startup manual, or here's a calling card for my marketing business in the form of a book. And I'm like, no, that's not really a book. That's just a book length text document. A book is something that's crafted to be a book. There's a certain way that books work. They're experiences over time. They have, they should pull you through a kind of an argument or a kind of experience that takes you somewhere, so that you can't just read the introduction in the first chapter and know each other chapter. It's like, present shock for business, present shock for education, present shock for, for home, present shock for church. That's not the way it goes. This is a book that goes from, the future leaning society that we were in all the way to the apocalyptic society that we're kind of facing now, this quest for an ending and all that. So if I have a book that I understand that taking this amount of time from people and this kind of attention from people should only be done when I think it's something that truly, truly deserves it. Most of the things I write about don't require a book, but in this case, the most radical thing about Present Shock is that it's a book itself, is that it is a book, and that I've decided, yes, it's worth your time. It's worth you pushing pause and taking these hours and having this experience. And if you can't do that, then it's worth looking at, what have we done? What have we done that we can't read a book anymore? That a book is too personal or too deep or too profound or too contemplative or too isolating. To be a human mind being with itself and being with a work of writing for that long is not it's not inappropriate, particularly in a world where we desperately need that space to contemplate.
Well, I have to say, your book is definitely worth our time. Thank you.
Oh, gosh, thank you.
That was great. Thanks.
Cool.
Thanks
a lot.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, bye.